Hello there, and welcome to Beyond the Surface, where the saying to be seen is to be understood comes to life. I want to begin by first honouring the traditional custodians of the land we live and work on. I live and work on Gundungurra land, and I acknowledge the traditional landowners of my guests near and far. I pay my respects to the elders past, present, and emerging, for they hold the memories, the traditions, and cultures of our First Nations people. The land below my feet is, was, and always will be Aboriginal land. I'm no stranger to the profound journey of pain, grief, anger, and heartbreak that often accompanies the loss of church, community, faith, and the unwinding of our core beliefs. In the midst of this, though, I found healing in the stories shared by others who walked a similar path to me. Here in the warmth of these digital walls, I want you to feel at home. This is a space where your memories and your story is not just acknowledged, but deeply seen and believed. So kick back, relax, and let's embark on a journey where your story is not just heard, but embraced. I want to welcome you to a community where storytelling is a powerful force. This is Beyond the Surface.
Welcome, Steph. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me, Sam.
I'm so excited about this episode. Like I mentioned to you earlier, my wife and I basically devoured your book, and for different reasons, but obviously both of us having our own lived experience in the church, both coming out, so many relatability moments in there, and as I'm sure it will come out, but I have my own little I was gonna say love affair, but it's not very loving. My own little experience with the Sydney Anglican Church. So I'm reading it and I'm, noticing little like the two ways to live tracts and, all of these little things where I'm going, oh my gosh, I haven't like heard that for so long. So your book is called In Out, A Scandalous Story of Falling Into Love and Out of the Church. And so many people, I would imagine, will perhaps know you because you made pretty big headlines. And I'm, we will get to that part in terms of why you made headlines. But where does your story start?
My story with religion and with Christianity in particular starts before I was born because, as will be the case with a lot of listeners around the world, particularly in the West, my parents both inherited Christian traditions from their families. They're quite different traditions. So my dad is from Western Europe, a Catholic country called Luxembourg. And my mum has a Fijian Indian parent and an Anglo-Australian parent, and she grew up in the Methodist Church. So already there's quite a mixture there of different church influences. And then from an early age, we went to church as a family, not necessarily because it was something my parents were devoted to, but because it was part of the rhythms of life for both of them growing up. And so it was a habit that they continued when they had kids.
It's a traditional thing for so many families, isn't it? It's,
Yeah, I think it
it's
is.
culture.
It is. I mean, whether you go on those big moments of Christmas and Easter or whether you go every week, I think it still is baked into the way that so many people live in Western countries.
Yeah, absolutely. What was it like in terms of did it impact the way that you were raised or your upbringing, or was it very much like a cultural nominal sort of situation?
Again, I think there are different ways to answer that question based on the influence of my dad's side of the family and my mum's side. It wasn't particularly intense or devotional. We didn't read the Bible at home except for maybe an illustrated Bible story occasionally before bed. And my parents would pray with us before bed just as a ritual, as a way to settle and to calm us down. But other than these little habits that were normal to me at the time but didn't seem especially meaningful, it wasn't a huge part of my upbringing. It's definitely something that I took on more intensely for myself later in life and built upon in a way that my siblings didn't. So in that sense, I don't really describe myself as having grown up in a Christian family the way some of your guests might and other people do. But there was a bit of a background understanding of Christianity because of those cultural influences and those routines that my family adhered to.
I find it really interesting when I chat to people who weren't raised in a religious or in a Christian home overtly, because I also wasn't. And so I always find it really interesting because I find that people's experiences, their trauma, their deconstruction looks really different to those who it was, baked into their everyday growing up. So how did you land to being, more involved in the church? When did that happen for you?
The way I've sort of narrated that as I've looked back has been to really ground it in the turmoil of being a pre-teenager and then being a teenager. I think being a kid and then enduring that transition from being a kid to being a grown up is a really tricky thing. And all of us look for ways to navigate it in different places. For me, I had a lot of big questions about who I was and what the purpose of life was. And there was something about the church input that I was getting through scripture at school. I went to a public primary school, but we had a volunteer scripture teacher come and speak to us. And also through the local youth group. Those were two sources of Christian teaching that I latched onto more seriously as I was growing up. And I think I found in the teachings at the church and in the scripture classes something that helped me answer some of those big questions. The concept of sin in particular gave me a way of accounting for the things about my own behavior that others struggled with. I had a temper as a kid and I was often getting in trouble for being angry. And so I wanted to understand why I was like that. And I also wanted to understand why there was suffering in the world more broadly. And the theology of original sin and of sin's impact on the world that I found in the very conservative strain of Christianity that I was sort of orbiting at that point gave me those answers. And so I think as I saw a fit between my questions and the answers that that community could provide, and as I saw a fit between the longings that I had for understanding and for belonging and what that community was offering, I gravitated more and more towards it. And I think it's probably also important to say that there was some family breakdown at that point in my life, including my parents' divorce. And I think that the church, with its really cross-generational, multi-generational community of grandparent-aged folks and parent-aged folks and peers and younger kids, stepped in as a family. And my Christian friends' family stepped in as a family for me. And so, yeah, both from a psychological and cognitive and emotional standpoint, there was a lot that the church was giving me at that point in time. So yeah, that's how I landed in my pursuit of meaning and community in the church.
Yeah, it's a very common conversation that I have that one of the things that churches do well is community, is that they fill a lot of gaps for people. And it's that, I think we have an innate sense to belong and to feel like we fit somewhere. And for a while, I think churches provide that sense of belonging until you step outside of that mold. And then you perhaps have a really, like a really rough realization that that belonging was conditional. And that's a really painful realization for a lot of people. But you know, that preteen teen is that identity forming time, isn't it? And you know, it's not uncommon for us to go searching. Now, having read your book, I know that you land with the Sydney Anglicans, and I actually talk about them fairly broadly quite often because they, if people are not aware, I tend to explain that the Sydney Anglicans are you not your typical Anglicanism. It is a very fundamental stream of that space. And so what was it like being a teenager in that space?
As someone who has always been a fairly serious person in some ways, I can also be very silly, but I have a very serious side and I think deeply about things and always have. There was a lot about the intensity, the religious fervour, the rigidity of the rules in Sydney Anglicanism that I found quite appealing. I think I have come later in life to the skill of seeing the grey areas. And certainly when I was a young teenager, I fell prey to black and white thinking a lot. Of course, at the time, I didn't think I was falling prey to it. I thought I was just being faithful. I thought I was being obedient. I thought I was doing the right thing by delineating between good and evil, right and wrong, wise and unwise, godly and ungodly. So there was a lot about Christian, about Sydney Anglican Christianity that was a good fit for me. And I think that has sort of been my experience that a lot of people who are, shall we say, successful within Sydney Anglicanism, who thrive in that community for a time and who find a strong sense of belonging, probably share some of those traits that I have. So a good friend of mine, he was also, a bit of a poster boy in the Sydney Anglican Church for a long time, and he's equally a very deep thinker, very serious, very hard on himself and others, was for a long time prone to thinking in a very black and white manner. So we share some of those characteristics. And I remember as I was constructing my faith and preparing to leave the church completely, I remember reflecting that when I think about a lot of the Sydney Anglican leaders that I knew over the decades and the people that are still inhabiting leadership roles in the hierarchies of that church, a lot of them have those tendencies as well. Perhaps some of them are looking to find answers and find meaning in the context of extraordinary trauma that they've undergone. Maybe they just have intense personalities. Maybe they have very rigid thinking styles as well. But there seems to be a personality type that thrives in that environment. And I think, and this is just, I'm just thinking off the cuff, I think it is quite a masculine environment, both theologically and socially and culturally. And I've always been a tomboy. I have quite a masculine energy in a lot of ways. And so I think that was a good fit for me. And that's probably why it was just like, it was my world for so long.
And so was it very quick that it became all consuming, or did that build?
No, I was in boots and all. As soon as I sort of understood the logic of the gospel, the story at the heart of that two ways to live tract that we mentioned earlier, that's sort of when I made a commitment that, yeah, this is what I believe and this is going to shape my life. And then over the course of the ensuing years, my behavior, my habits, my thinking, my social life, my plans for the future all started to fall into line with that particular worldview. And so yeah, the intensity was there pretty much straight away. And it was fostered and reinforced by the communities like youth groups and churches and Bible studies and camps and mentoring relationships with older Christians and that sort of thing. I don't think it was a gradual build.
I find that the people who deconstruct the hardest were all in and very quickly. It was not a gradual thing, most of the time.
No, and I think that's probably because there wasn't a great deal of critical thought that went into my decision to become a member of that church. It was very much a, it met my needs, and so I went for it, and it made sense to me. You know, that the internal logic of the worldview made sense to me, and so yeah, I was very quick to follow, following is encouraged. Obedience is encouraged. Critical thinking is not necessarily encouraged. And so there wasn't really anything obviously wrong with that approach at the time that I took it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think critical thinking is encouraged as long as it always leads you back to the right place and back to the truth and back to the framework that you are being taught, essentially. So, what were some of the messages that you internalized about yourself and the way that you moved in the world?
I understood myself as a sinner, and I think that was very foundational to my self-understanding. It's hard to know what the chicken and what the egg is, but I think I've always had a self-critical tendency. That could be due to any number of things in my family culture and in my past, or it could be that the chicken or the egg, whichever comes first, is the very dour anthropology that this kind of Christianity has. So the kind of Christianity, Sydney Anglicanism that I was part of says we are sinful from birth and that we are fundamentally tainted by original sin and completely helpless without God's grace. And so to understand myself as being damaged and broken and helpless in that state gave me a way to account for how shit I felt about myself. And it gave me a way to understand why I let myself down, why I let other people down. And I mean, along with that came the promise that, through God's help, I would be able to be better and yada yada yada. But yeah, that was a really important message for me. I think also the direction and the purpose that came from the worldview I had, the idea that the world was created with a purpose, not by accident and not randomly, that every person on this earth somehow was given a role in the cosmic drama of God's plan for the universe, that time was heading towards somewhere, that there was going to be an ending and a resolution and an outcome and an eternity that sort of resolved in one way or another. I think that was also a huge thing for me, because you look around you at the ages of, I'm thinking of these key points in my life, like 12, 15, 18, 20, and you go, well, what am I doing here? And the framework of my faith helped me to answer all those questions and to choose a direction and then to stick with it.
Yeah, it's the big ticket questions, right? They're
For
things.
sure.
Now I know what the Sydney Anglicans teach about this, but for people who don't know, what were you taught about sex, sexuality, gender, relationships, everything that falls into that sphere?
I'd say many of the things that non-church-going people would perhaps term traditional beliefs about these things are pretty similar to what I was taught at church. So the idea that gender is binary, the idea that sex takes place between heterosexually married people, the idea that homosexuality or any diversion from hetero normativity and cisgender identity is a mistake or a problem or an error. These are all things that were very clear, very black and white. There was no room for discussion in those matters in the church communities that I grew up in. Marriage was taken very seriously, and within marriage, there were particular roles that you performed based on whether or not you were a man or a woman. And marriage, as well as being having a social function, was also sort of theologized in a way that gave it a huge place in church and in life. And that's because the relationship, as you would know, the relationship between husband and wife is construed as this miniature version of the relationship between Christ and the church, this sacrificial love of Christ being reflected in the sacrificial love of a husband, and the faithful, willing submission of the church to Christ being reflected in the behavior of a wife towards her husband. And so those were things that I took on board and didn't question and lived by very seriously for the majority of my life thus far.
Was there any internal questioning of those when you were younger?
Internal, yeah, I mean, it's really because almost pre-verbal, pre-cognitive way, I think I was questioning my sexuality from a very young age, from as young as perhaps 8 or 9. But the culture, the social norms, as well as then later on the religious teachings that I was coming into contact with so frequently, were so clear about the fact that gay identity was sinful, and that gay, well, I should clarify, there are, as you know, various standpoints on whether or not actually being gay is considered wrong, but certainly living a gay life was really problematic. And so, being as clear as it was within the church community that I was a part of, I never really let those inklings have any purchase in my life. I didn't really voice them to anyone except in a few really awkward, oblique attempts, during my later teen years when I was trying to work out what my feelings meant. But not really, not really. I didn't really have anyone whose way of thinking or way of being opened up a space for me to ask those questions honestly and openly. So they just sort of remained inklings.
And I think I find for some people, they don't enter in because they're so demonized almost. They're so dangerous. It's so risky. There is almost, they will say there's no hierarchy of sin, but there is absolutely a hierarchy of sin, right? And that is top of the list. And so there is, I find even for myself, entertaining it was just not possible. It was not ever an option. If something's never presented, it's like if a child grows up, this is a really bad example, but Frankie Muniz on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here had never had a strawberry before, right? So if a child grows up never knowing that strawberries exist, how do they know whether they like strawberries or not? And so if a child grows up only ever knowing that heterosexual relationships are an option, how are they supposed to know that anything else is even possible? And obviously we know that sexuality is much more complex than strawberries, but it kind of it paints that picture that if somebody is so indoctrinated to one way, nothing else is an option, nothing else is possible. And that makes it really difficult for people to really fully explore every part of their identity when they're a young person.
I think to extend that example a little further, it's almost as though you've never experienced or tasted a strawberry before, and yet there's a sensation in you that you will later come to recognize was always the craving for a strawberry, but you just didn't have the vocabulary, the phenomenology to understand it and to put that question into words at the time. And I think that's why retrospect and the way that we remember and piece together our stories with hindsight is so interesting. And yeah, I think that's perhaps one way of understanding my relationship with my own awareness of same-sex attraction.
And I think, what I've noticed even in clients that I work with who have come out later in life is that I have had a few people say, I just thought I was really good at purity culture. Like, I just thought I was, I just wasn't attracted to boys. And I just thought that that was God blessing me with that purity, that ability to put him first as opposed to focus on boys like everybody else around me was. And I find, we do often find ways to make it make sense at the time with the information and the knowledge that we have at the time. What was it like for you in terms of, I obviously know the end of the book, so I'm trying to like phrase questions to like tease it out. In terms of, obviously we know that you landed teaching in a Christian school, and so I would imagine that that just adds a layer of intensity in terms of you are now not just living this for you, you are teaching it. Also, in terms of like modeling, there would be, I would imagine, a real strict ethos and things like that in private Christian schools. What was it like for you to be in that environment?
Honestly, it was kind of like being at church every day because the culture of the church that I was a part of at the time had a lot of families and kids in it, and lots of adults who viewed the world the same way, and we're all kind of more or less aiming for the same things. By being members of that church, we sort of had a shorthand way of knowing what each other valued and what our goals were and that sort of thing. So, being part of the school that shared a very similar ethos and had families from, or children from families that attended lots of different churches very similar to mine, was kind of like having that in your life 5 days a week. And so, yeah, there was obviously a very strong Christian ethos and very clear expectation that staff model the godliness that we thought was so important that we wanted to impart to the kids as well. But it didn't feel intense or alien in any way because it was so similar to the rest of my life and the culture that I was inhabiting during that time.
What was your personal relationship with God like throughout all of this? Has it been a while since somebody's asked you that question?
Yeah, I actually, yeah, that was weird. I think a cornerstone of my relationship with God has always been journaling. I've kept a prayer journal since I was 11, and I still keep a journal, but it's just addressed to Dear Diary, not Dear Lord anymore. I was very committed to reading my Bible and memorizing scripture. I thought of prayer as kind of a 24/7 conversation with God. So there would be times when I would pray for specific things, but I would pretty much maintain a dialogue with God throughout the day. I thought that's kind of what it was supposed to be, a relationship rather than a laundry list, as they, liked to say at church. And I think I probably thought of myself as having quite a strong and stable relationship with God, with those dry spells and those, periods of apathy and of complacency that we all experience, no matter what kind of habit we're trying to maintain. So yeah, I think it was pretty normal for someone. Well, I mean, what does that mean? What, normal? The idea of talking to God all day, every day, and reading the Bible and trying to memorize it probably doesn't sound very normal, and it certainly isn't normal for me anymore. But it felt very normal at the time. It felt like I was ticking all the boxes.
Now I'm trying, it's been a while since I read your book, but I'm imagining, I feel like I read that you almost described it a little bit like a desert. Is that like that, like a man under a hat, but never quite getting close enough to sort of see beneath the hat? Am I just like merging different books, or is that
No, that is definitely in my book. So the opening of the book, actually, because something that I find very compelling about Krista Tippett's podcast on being, excuse me, is that she asks all of her guests about the spiritual background of their childhood and the way that they view God often comes into that. And so my publisher thought it was a bit odd, to be honest, but I wanted to include that as the first part of the book because it's the earliest thought that I had about God. It's the earliest memory that I have of some sort of image of God in my mind. And I tried really hard in that little snippet to try and to convey what it looks like when I close my mind, or what it looked like as a kid when I would close my eyes and go, okay, what does God look like? And that it was that desert. It was that very formidable figure in the distance, whose face is shrouded in shadow, and you really want to see what's underneath it, but there's a an unapproachability there. So, yeah, I think later in life, when my Christianity became more intense, more informed by the Anglican or the Sydney Anglican tradition, the Reformed tradition, probably I related to God in a different way. That image has always been there in my mind, but perhaps the lack of approachability and the coldness that you get in that opening scene that I have in the book isn't how I saw God in that really fervent period of my life. So yeah, like perhaps that's a little confusing for people. They think that, as I go through my life as a Christian, I'm just talking to this giant cowboy in the sky. But it's and it's not quite like that. It's just an insight into those earliest conceptions of God that I had, in my life.
I think it's a really great insight into the progression that that takes also. And I mean, my brain automatically went to, I feel like sometimes a cowboy in the sky would have been a better image than what I had at different points of my life. That probably would have been a really great image to have. But yeah, I think it just shows a natural progression in terms of, a relationship, whether it be with a divine figure or a person, is going to have different seasons and different moments, and we will have different feelings about it. And so, yeah, I think it just gives insight into the progression of that relationship that you had. Now, you obviously married a man. I know that.
Is it obvious?
But I'm curious what it was like for you, because I obviously know, like you sort of gave a really good picture of before, marriage is put on a pedestal. It is the be all and all. Like, it is the goal, particularly for women. It is the goal. Like, you are basically nothing without that. It's like your purpose in life is to be a wife and a mum. And so I'm curious what it was like for you internally in terms of wrestling and yet marrying.
I think I'd want to start by saying that there were a few very, very influential and very wonderful unmarried women, unmarried Christian women in my experience growing up, in the church. And I want to honor them because that would have been really hard. Because,
Absolutely.
as you say, being a wife and a mother it is important in the church, and it is something that's held up as an example. And not everyone does it. And some of the people who don't are some of the most amazing people I met during my years in the church. But you're right, it is definitely something that I feel is, it's still the case in the culture outside the church that marriage is a safe bet for women. Well, it can seem that way until you realize that you've been trapped. But then I think also it's given this theological bolstering by the story of marriage as a microcosm for the relationship between Christ and the church. And so not only is there the existing cultural pressure to marry because of social and economic reasons, but there's a theological impetus there too. It was the natural path for me as I was growing up to go, okay, well, I've finished high school and I'm approaching adulthood now, and my purpose in life is to be faithful to God. And statistically, the most likely way that that's going to happen is to make Christian babies with a Christian man and raise them in the Lord, and go to church every Sunday and do my best job of that. And I did find that a little bit daunting because I thought it didn't sound very adventurous or very fun. But I think when all my friends started coupling up, the loneliness that comes from your friends meeting someone and going down the partner rabbit hole, it's real. And I think I felt it quite strongly at that point. And I think I had I dated a few Christian guys and then thought, well, I better make it work with someone. And that person was my ex-husband, whom I call Ben in the book. So Ben is a wonderful man who was my friend first, and then we started dating, and then about 2 years after that, we got married.
And obviously you are no longer married.
That is correct.
And I mean, I think just before we sort of like get into the reason you made headlines, I'm gonna just keep rolling at that. But there is I think it is underestimated, like you said, the impact that it has on particularly young women where, and particularly young closeted women who all of their friends are getting engaged, are getting married. And I remember thinking, what is wrong with me? Like, and it becomes a, not that it just hasn't happened yet. That's not the way that the brain works. The brain tends to go, well, like what's wrong with me that I am not that I'm not finding that person, and why is God not blessing me? Because that's the way that it's supposed to go. So I must be doing something wrong for that to be the case. And I think the impact that that has on someone's identity and self-worth is really overwhelming for a lot of people, really overwhelming. And I think really underestimated as well. I think, people just see it as, differing rites of passage, but it's not quite as simple as that in the moment.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think also whether or not you end up being one of a person like me, or perhaps like you, Sam, who comes out and goes, oh, okay, well, that's why it wasn't quite working for me at that point. I think for any woman in the church who's struggling to partner up, regardless of the gender identity or sexuality that they identify with, it's just tough because it's a very coupley culture. I just want to acknowledge that queer people have a particularly hard time of it because they're invisible in the church, or if they're not invisible, they're not viewed positively. But it's certainly not an experience that's limited to queer people.
Yeah, absolutely. Singleness is not viewed well either. So,
No, nor is and I mean this is another can of worms, but the choice not to have children.
yeah, absolutely. Okay, so tell us a little bit about I guess the coming in and out of your marriage, in finding your sexuality, and the way that you made headlines.
Okay, I will do my best to be succinct
Yeah.
about that. So Ben and I were married for 5 years, and towards the end of our 5-year marriage, we left the church where we had met and had our wedding, and we decided to go to another church where there were more couples our age who were thinking about starting a family, because Ben and I thought that that was what God would want us to do with our lives, to be parents, if that was biologically going to work. So we started going to another church there, and shortly after that, I started a friendship with a woman called Ella, who was leading the music at that church, and she and I became very close and started talking about our inklings of crushes on women and our experiences with that sort of confusion, and that sort of desire. And I think the intimacy that that bred in that friendship, being able to be open enough with each other to talk about that, very quickly developed into a sexual and a romantic intimacy as well. So I started having an affair with her while I was still married to Ben. And that was a very, it was a very full-on experience in so many ways. The way that I felt about her and the contrast between the intensity of our relationship and the lack of anything comparable in any relationship I'd ever had with a man, even Ben, was
Yeah.
quite striking. And obviously, it created a whole lot of chaos because I was sinning in so many different ways. And what ended up happening is that the experience that I had of meeting and falling in love with Ella was so strong and so transformative and so illuminating for me of things about myself and my life and the world that I couldn't just turn my back on it as a mistake and go back to the way things had been.
Yeah.
David Gushee, who's a Christian ethicist, talks about these transformative encounters that no reason or sermon can achieve. It's actually when you come face to face with someone and their story, that's the thing that can change your heart and mind. And for me, it was that encounter with Ella that was the catalyst. So at this point, as I said before, I was employed at a Christian school that had very strong Christian ethics, and that included the teachings about marriage and sexuality that we spoke about earlier. So I knew that them learning of me, questioning my sexuality, cheating in my marriage, don't love the word cheating, but you know what I mean, and yeah, and sort of stepping outside the box of acceptable ways of being, it wasn't going to go well. So after I thought about it long and hard, I approached the school and I said, look, my marriage has broken down. I identify as, I think I used the word lesbian. And I think that it's possible to be a Christian, to be a Christian who teaches at this school, and to be myself in all the ways that I'm learning about that at the moment. And they engaged in some back and forth with me. They got lawyers, I got a lawyer, very official and wordy letters were written. And then that all culminated in them firing me at the beginning of 2021. The reason for it being that my beliefs about sexuality and my identity as a homosexual person excluded me or precluded me from being able to sign on to their statement of faith. And so that was that.
And I remember hearing about this when it made mainstream media, I guess. And I remember thinking, I mean, my first thought was, are you fucking kidding me? And that was my first thought. And then my second thought was, once I heard more and I realized that it was a Sydney Anglican school, I was like, okay, now I'm not surprised on top of that. But then once I got rid of all of the non-shock but shock, I was heartbroken for you. And so I'm just thinking, like, what was that like for you in the moment to lose your marriage, your job, and to be grappling with something new whilst, I mean, there's so much loss coupled with so much newness. Like, newness is not a word, but like so many revelations, but so much loss at the same time.
It was a lot, and I think I think it's one of those things where I went into shock for a very long time and managed to function at a quite a high level, and then it's sort of taking, not taken, but taking years to work its way through my system and to really experience all of that. Because if we say that I became a Christian at 12, which was, when I first understood the message and decided that that's what I wanted to give my life to the age of 29 when I was fired, that's a long time. That's almost 20 years of my life, and 20 very formative years. And so I think it stands to reason that it's going to take a long time for me to reckon with the cost of it and to rebuild. So I find that question difficult to answer because it's still happening. I knew going into the conversation with the school that because of the way that the laws are in Australia still, me being fired was a possibility and even a likelihood. So I was prepared for that outcome in the sense that it wasn't a surprise to me that they could do that. It was a surprise to me that as someone I know, as someone who I know was a beloved member of the school community there, they could so clinically remove me. I think I talk in the book about the fact that having been a card-carrying member of a very fundamentalist kind of Christianity, I understand the thinking that went into them firing me. But that when there's love between people, it's sad when that love is, it seems not to matter compared to the purity of the doctrine and the fear of compromise. So yeah, it was a tricky time. As I attest in the book, it was a very emotionally turbulent time for other reasons too, and it all sort of collapsed on top of me shortly after I was fired, and my mental health was very, very bad. But yeah, I think I'd want to just sort of frame all of that by saying that that was maybe the epicenter, and the aftershocks are in progress still.
How long was it between when you received the letter to when the media latched onto it?
Yeah, I was fired in January of 2021, and then the media story came out in August 2021 because the Morrison government's religious discrimination bill was up for debate. And so, in that context, some journalists and some advocacy groups like Equality Australia wanted to put human faces and human stories out there about who these laws are affecting and how changing these laws might further affect people. And so that was sort of the context in which my story broke in the media. It's coming up to, it'll be 3 years this August.
What was it like for you navigating the media with that? Because that's, there's a lot of pain and a lot of loss and a lot of heartbreak with that scenario to be doing that now in a public forum with people and cameras and lights and all of, that comes with mainstream media. What was that like for you?
I mean, the media side of things I actually really enjoy. I've always been a bit of a performer. And so I think I didn't mind the opportunity to speak with people and, the thrill of finding out what it's like to be on television and that sort of thing. I found that all fairly exciting. And I think I allowed myself to enjoy that excitement because I was confident that what I was saying was going to be helpful and hopefully kind. I wasn't trying to start fights. So yeah, so that was good. I think every time I talk about it, it's exhausting. But there is also a part of me that goes, well, I decided to do this because I want people to feel less alone. I want people to feel comforted in some way, and perhaps a little glimmer of, oh, it's not always going to feel this crap. And maybe the world can possibly be a little bit better. So the tiring conversations and the, not that this is one of them, Sam, I'm not saying,
No,
but
that's okay.
it's when, no, it's just when you get these antagonists asking you things like, oh, well, why did you choose to work at a Christian school anyway? I mean, it's those things. It's getting around that and going, well, hang on a second. If Christian schools that have Christian people, many of whom are going to turn out to be LGBT, don't have LGBT people to care for and to model those, what it is to be a person of intersecting identities, then that's not a positive thing. And so it's trying to get around that stuff and get to the positive aspects of the story that's what I've tried to focus on. Anyway, that was a bit of a garbled answer, but
No, I think I mean, one of the reasons that I started this podcast was because I wanted people to realize that they weren't alone in their experiences, and to realize that there is community beyond the church if you choose to leave, and that it doesn't, you don't always live in that pain. Like, there is hope that you can move through that. But I also recognize that it is exhausting. And as somebody who has her own religious trauma and journey, I talk quite openly about the fact that I listening to other people's stories also zaps my energy and things like that. And so, I think wherever there is trauma, there is like an energy output that comes when we share that, whether it be verbally in podcasts or in the media or even in writing it. It still is an energy output in terms of we need to monitor that, because it's not easy. But stories like this are needed in the world. And so I'm thankful for you sharing. But I recognize that it's not an easy space for people to bear their soul, essentially, and their trauma. I find people who say, well, why were you working in a Christian school anyway? I go, that's like saying to somebody who was a shark attack victim, well, why did you go and swim in the ocean anyway? It just is not a helpful, like, that's just not a helpful statement to say.
It just dodges the issue, doesn't it?
And life is not that simple, and life is not that black and white and binary. And if it was, we wouldn't be having these conversations. Life is complex, and humans are complex, and it is not, it's just not as simple as that. What was it like for you to put all of that on paper?
It was good. It was kind of like finding a jumbled ball of wool and slowly but surely untangling it and trying to, I mean, it's not all neatly wrapped up, but at least some of those really tricky knots, it helped me to undo them for myself. Knots like, the emotional pain of losing my faith, and knots like coming to terms with the loss of friendships and coming to terms with how I ever believed some of these outlandish Christian ideas in the first place, So, putting pen to paper has always been a way for me of trying to clarify, and the process of writing the book definitely did that for me too. So I benefited a lot from it, and I'm just grateful to know that there are people out there reading it who are finding it beneficial as well.
Where is your sense of spirituality now?
It's fairly nebulous. It's fairly flimsy. It's a lot of it is found in a sense of awe at nature, which is just something so prosaic in some ways, because I don't think any of us really can deny how wonderful it is to observe a sunset and to marvel at how incredible that is.
But it is also so every day. It's so you almost wish there was something more exceptional to say about it, or to point to, because that's really the only thing at the moment that I sort of look at and go, wow, like that I feel something. I think sometimes also the experience of enjoying a really thought-provoking piece of art or piece of music evokes the same thing. But whereas I used to have something to point to, to go, wow, that sunset, that is God's glory in a tiny little way shown to us so that we might worship him and marvel at him. Now I just look at the sunset and I go, wow, I'm just another person in awe of this sunset, and I don't quite know where to direct that awe, but it's still just there, I suppose.
It is, I find, when I sort of came out of my faith or sort of, deconstructing, I don't use the word deconstructing, but I use the word detangling, but essentially amongst all of that chaos, I sort of, it's so hard to know where to give credit to almost, because you're so used to giving God all of the credit and all of the glory, that I actually remember reading in another book. I think it was Sarah Hen Haywood who talked about giving the credit almost to herself that she is able to witness something so beautiful in nature. And I was like, I like that. Like, that's a really beautiful way to, because I mean, in most streams of Christianity, you don't get the credit for anything. So I like
Except
that.
for fucking things up.
Absolutely. Okay. And so this, and I am very aware that this might be a very broad question. But where is your sense of wholeness in terms of your sexuality and your identity? How is that going?
I think I just don't try anymore. I think I tried so hard for so long. Tried to be what I thought it was, to be a girl and a young woman and then a wife and then a teacher and then a church leader. And I just don't try anymore. I really don't. Like I dress differently, I speak differently. I don't really police myself the way I used to. And I think my sense of identity, both in my sexuality and in any other aspect, it's still pretty embryonic, post exit from the church. But there is a real sense of having let go of that effort and that gritting your teeth to try and be what it is you think you should be. So that's a relief.
It sounds like letting go of not just the labels, but the conformity.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah. I really don't, I really don't mind. I used to really care that people would say, oh, I don't think that's really an appropriate thing to wear to that. These days, I just go, good for you for thinking that, and I'm going to wear it anyway.
Absolutely.
That's just a little example for me of what it means to have let go of that facade,
I think people think that that freedom has to come in huge, big thinking and big ticket items. And I think that, we sort of used, I used that term earlier because I think that tends to be your thinking when you are in like a fundamental space, which is everything has this grand purpose or this eternal purpose. But I find that for so many people, the freedom does come in the little things, in terms of like the freedom to sleep in on a Sunday, to like how many people just love their Sunday sleep-ins, and the freedom to, like you said, to wear what you want to wear and to watch the movie that you were always supposed to avoid and enjoy
True.
that. And I think that they're the little things that people that br they bring up. It's often not the big things, it's the little things.
Yeah, that's a really good observation.
So, we are now April 2024. What brings you joy and peace?
I sleep a lot these days, and I just give myself permission to do that. I don't know if I am maybe like low in iron, or whether I just am catching up on years of missed sleep because I was up early for church on a Sunday. I'm just really trying to lean into letting myself rest. I really enjoy making things, and so I try to write and be creative and use my hands, whether it's making food or fixing up old furniture, that sort of thing. I find that very very satisfying and very calming. So those are some things that I love as well. But I'm also still figuring that out, because for so long my life was governed by a lot of shoulds. And I was so good at the shoulds that I made myself believe that that's what I actually liked and that's what I actually wanted. And so I'm sort of unlearning that stuff, and then just trying to be patient while the things I actually am genuinely drawn to reveal themselves to me in time. So, yeah, again, work in progress.
And I think that exploratory stage that you are in can be so enjoyable. I mean, it can also be terrifying, but it can also be really enjoyable. I think the more that we can see rest as a productive use of our time, the better off the world will be. But I think, when you are part of that sort of fundamental space, you are almost in masking and survival mode all of the time. You are always trying to fit that narrow view of conformity that you are supposed to do, ticking all of those shoulds. That the come down when you leave that is a little bit like aftershocks, and your body does need to catch up to itself. We like I'm a therapist. We hold trauma in our body, and so your body needs to catch up to itself and to catch up to where you are at and reorient almost. So I love that. Okay, I have been finishing all of these episodes by asking, what would you say to somebody who is fresh in their deconstruction?
Have you seen The Life of Pi?
No, I see the tiger. This is going to give you really insight into my life, but I see the tiger on the front cover, and I'm too scared to watch it because I would much prefer to see humans killed in a movie than animals. And I'm too scared that the tiger gets hurt or injured or lost or scared or sad or anything unpleasant that I just cannot handle sad animals. So no, I haven't seen it.
No, that's okay. Well, what I'm about to say is not, it has nothing to do with tiger welfare. All the animals, well, they're actually not really relevant to my point about the film. But I just think there are so many scenes in that movie of this guy in a tiny boat at sea, and the scale of the framing of the image is just sea everywhere, and this tiny, tiny little boat that you can hardly see in the vastness of the ocean. And I think if you've been part of a highly controlling religious community, and if you've had a very fundamentalist black and white faith, and then you find yourself deconstructing those things, I think what I would say is it's really hard, and there's no going back. Once you lose those beliefs, unbelief is unavoidable, and you can't stuff it back in the box, and that's a great source of grief. So I think I would want to just validate what you are doing is really hard, and I wish you didn't have to. And I don't know where you'll end up, and I don't know how it's going to feel and how it's going to go. And the best thing about it is that there are other people also experiencing that great sense of confusion and disorientation and betrayal and letdown, and uncertainty. And it is a comfort to know that there are other people who are just as, just as let down and as disillusioned. There are some great and freeing moments when you start to dismantle oppressive ideas. But ultimately, it's like, well, I've left this safe ground that I thought I was standing on, and now I'm in this vast ocean, and I can't see any other land anywhere, and I don't even know if there is any. So somehow I'm going to have to learn just to make it here, until whatever happens, happens. Which is perhaps not the inspiring pep talk that you might have wanted from me, but
But you know what? This is not a sermon. Like,
no, no.
we can't always, we can't always wrap it up in a nice little box and put a bow on it.
No.
But I mean, what I got from that is, you are not alone in the destabilization that will come. And I think that that is inspiring. I think that is encouraging, is anytime somebody can feel less alone, that's only going to help and support that person. So,
Yeah, I think that's probably true. Yeah.
thank you so much for joining me,
Well,
despite
thank
the
you for having
exhaustion.
me. No, I feel really bad. I genuinely wasn't referring
No.
to you when I said that.
No.
I really enjoy speaking with people. Here's the thing that I think that I probably worded badly before. It's when you're speaking to people who haven't had an experience of what we're chatting about. Let's just say that you had zero idea what I've been through. Your questions would be much less empathetic, much less nuanced, much less interesting. But because we share so much in what we've been through, we can have a really honest conversation and understand each other to an extent. And hopefully there'll be listeners who can kind of understand the shorthand of some of the things we're talking about too. But I think the exhaustion comes from just constantly having to explain things that were so fundamental to your worldview for so long to somebody who has never even countenanced that idea. So, yeah, this has been a real pleasure, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity. Thank you, Sam. And thank you for the energy that you expend in your work as well to help people.
Thanks, Steph.
Thanks for listening to Beyond the Surface. Until next time, take care, stay true to who you are, and remember, your voice and your story matters always.